Augustmund. I am a co-founder of Gyroscope, which is a decentralized stablecoin protocol and liquidity protocol. And today I'm going to talk a bit about how to make decentralized stablecoins more super liquid. And this talk is going to be a mix of our work building out Gyroscope, as well as a background of academic work coming from our PhDs that went into actually building Gyroscope. And it's going to be a largely high-level talk, focusing on the concepts, but also trying to ground it in some real examples. So let's take stock of the stablecoin space and kind of start at the top. So there's something like a stablecoin renaissance right now, but at the same time, USDC and USDT are largely dominating the space. And what we see is there's a surge, particularly in centralized stablecoins coming to market. So this is like new contenders like PayPal's PiUSD, as well as Athena, which is a delta-neutral stablecoin, and other real-world assets mainly backed by T-bills. And at the same time, there's also an increasing maturity in decentralized stablecoins. So one example is there's no more Terra, there's no more Fei. And there's new innovative mechanisms that are coming to market, things like Curve USD, Gyroscope's GUID, which we built, obviously, and several more examples. But as a category, decentralized stablecoins haven't really grown in the last 2 years. And in fact, they've kind of shrunk in that time. So the main question we want to ask is why? And at least one reason, which is the focus of this talk, is that scaling liquidity at PEG is very hard. And actually, this applies to any stablecoin, but particularly to decentralized stablecoins as they're set up now. So one primary challenge is attracting any liquidity in the first place. And basically, new stablecoins, they have to attract new liquidity. And it compares with like USDC and USDT in many ways. It's like an inherent disadvantage because USDC and USDT have entrenched use cases and a lot of natural trading demand and pairings, which basically means that USDC and USDT LPs are independently profitable from trading volume. But when you start a new stablecoin, you have to start from zero. You don't have that. It's basically like a chicken or the egg problem. And it's very costly. Because the cost to attract stablecoin capital is basically between 15 and 30% these days. And also borrowing stablecoins is also similarly expensive. The second part of the challenge is competing with entrenched liquidity that's at PEG. And the scope of the problem becomes pretty clear when you start looking at historical price deviations. And this is something that also affects all new stablecoins. So the chart here is showing new centralized stablecoins that have come to market and showing a histogram of price deviations from PEG for those new stablecoins. And these are pretty major players, including like PiUSD and Athena. And one thing to note is just how regular the deviations of like 20 basis points or more actually occurs for these pretty major stablecoins, which adds quite a lot of friction in terms of the usability of these systems. So from the usability angle, one thing that's very important is how easy it is to move in and out of a new stablecoin, especially with low slippage being very important. And so 20 basis point deviations or more can be make it a lot more difficult to actually use the stablecoin. This is how decentralized stablecoins compare. So actually, you see a lot of similar problems with a lot of kind of like spread out pricing. But something that sparks some optimism is that there are actually two decentralized exceptions here. So there's both DAI and Gyroscope's GYD. I guess the DAI is a little hidden in the graphic, but it shows up very similarly. And this basically just presents some ideas that maybe you can actually do better by using some advantages of decentralized stablecoins. And then the third part of the challenge is that it's just very difficult technically, especially for decentralized stablecoins. And I'll walk through a few of these reasons. When a stablecoin's price is expected to move around, it becomes harder to get deep liquidity for it. And this is just a practical consequence. You need to spread liquidity over more prices. And you need to convince people to do that and take the risks of market making over that range of prices. And why does this happen? It usually comes down to frictions about the stablecoin design itself. So, for instance, frictions in minting or redeeming or otherwise issuing the stablecoin, which can come down to things like fees and speed of settlement. One thing to note is that, like, off-chain settlement, which is what you basically have to do for centralized stablecoins, can often be very slow, as can kind of cross-chain kind of mechanisms, where maybe if you mint on one chain, but you have to bridge to another chain, that can lead to kind of delays, in the worst case, up to, like, possibly a week. Another thing that comes into play quite a lot is that you often have to balance the interest rate between for a leverage market, for when you issue stablecoins in a borrow market. And the reason here is that the main use case is leverage for these sort of markets. People usually borrow the stablecoin and then sell the stablecoin. And the interest rate basically has to keep the stablecoin on peg by balancing the supply and the demand in that market, or else the stablecoin depegs. And then you can also have kind of like shocks to underlying assets and various risks. We actually did quite a lot of work in our research on this, but that's kind of not the focus of this talk, so we'll kind of leave that to... There's another good talk at previous DevCons, actually, if you're interested in that. But let's walk through one example here. So this is a case study of Go, which illustrates both of these kind of frictions coming to fruition at different points. So the price of Go has been pretty volatile since it launched. This is the pricing from this year. And there are two main reasons to this. The first reason is that in the first part of this chart, basically there were frictions to the interest rate borrowing balancing the borrow market. Basically, the go-to-market strategy relied on providing below equilibrium interest rates to kind of like incentivize supply. But that basically means that there are too many people trying to leverage and sell, and you end up just without a balanced market. And then the later part of this chart is another problem. So they fixed the interest rate sort of issue in Go, or changed the rates. There was a kind of an excess of incentives at one point. They did have a like one-to-one mechanism to mint new Go against like USDC and USDT, but unfortunately this was exhausted. And so you basically see kind of like above peg happening in that realm. But then they fixed that problem. But this kind of illustrates like where some of these pricing issues can come up. Okay, let's take one step back before we go any further, which is why should we care about decentralized stablecoins anyways? I mean, first you should think about like from fundamentals. I think a lot of us here care about actually like building decentralized things. We care about bringing too much counterparty risk in, or censorship risk, or geographic risk, or kind of like tying to particular custodians, or kind of locking into particular vendors. And this is a risk if you use too many centralized stablecoins, that you're basically embedding this into what we're building in DeFi. And what wasn't the point of DeFi, basically, to make things as decentralized as possible. But if you're still not convinced, then you can just also take the practical viewpoint, which there's a very good example. When USDC depegged in the SVB crisis, it basically took down DeFi for a few days, because this is how DeFi was constructed at the time. And in principle, we can build things that don't have this susceptibility, and that's another reason to kind of like build decentralized protocols that can manage the risks in a decentralized way without relying on a centralized institution to do it. Okay, so the rest of this talk is going to go through a bit of how do we make decentralized stablecoins super liquid, and we're going to run through quickly what the state of the art is, including some examples of what doesn't work, and then go through what we think is a better way, actually, to solve this. So the current state of the art focuses on two parts. The first is around designing primary markets for a new stablecoin. And so primary market basically means minting and redeeming, for a decentralized stablecoin in particular, on-chain mint and redeem. And one benefit to these decentralized stablecoins here is they can do this on-chain, which means that there's potentially a lot lower frictions than for a centralized stablecoin. So in particular, you can do mint and redeem atomically. So you can actually like kind of balance markets using flash loans instead of requiring market makers to take inventory. And this is actually why GYD and DAI in one of the earlier pictures was actually achieving a much tighter pricing than even Pi USD, because it has these advantages in its effectively mint and redeem market. And another idea is you can actually segment the where you need liquidity using mint and redeem. You can basically let the primary market handle the extremities of the pricing region, and then you can concentrate the secondary markets on the areas that are most important within kind of the minting or redemption bounds. A slight caution here is that there's a lot of risks to primary markets and building them in the right way. And this came about as an example also in like the SVB crisis. There's a whole other DevCon talk from last year actually about how do we build these in the best way. So I encourage you to check that out. But yeah, we'll just kind of give a quick nod to that here. You should of course be conscious of the risks that you're building into these systems. And one other topic about primary markets that I want to touch on is what's another version, another flavor of them that's called AMOs or POL. AMOs meaning algorithmic market operations, and POL meaning protocol-owned liquidity. So these are effectively where you have something that's like a pre-minted or not yet issued stablecoin that's been deposited into a liquidity pool. And basically somebody can issue the stablecoin by buying it from the liquidity pool. And this is basically equivalent to a mint and redeem sort of flow, but where the AMM price, the price curve is actually providing the pricing for mint and redeem. And it also has the benefit of being able to kind of bootstrap secondary markets, because you're basically depositing into something that gets blended with secondary market liquidity. And how does this affect liquidity at PEG? Well, actually, it comes down to quite a lot about specifically how it's implemented and the mechanism design around it. For GYD, it actually works very well. And there's an example here in this an illustration here. It's able to help bootstrap liquidity at PEG very well. But there are also cases where this doesn't work very well. And it comes down to a bit about either bad design or possibly kind of like miscalibration about exactly how the flow works. So a quick case study about that is basically digging into what happens in Frax AMOs. So in a Frax AMO, there's some injection of like this pre-minted Frax into curve pools. But Frax tends to trade below PEG, like kind of despite this mechanism trying to support it. And what you end up with is basically pools that aren't optimized for kind of the pricing of Frax, which you can see here. You can see something about like the density of liquidity in these liquidity pools versus the actual histogram of where prices are trading. The other side here is secondary markets. And I'm kind of going to breeze through this a bit. But the main idea is that you can kind of optimize liquidity density by, instead of picking default calibrations for a liquidity pool, making something that's much more customized for the actual prices that you want to incentivize as a stablecoin. And the graphic here kind of illustrates the concept that if you can basically squeeze more liquidity out of your liquidity pools if you can kind of identify the right bounds and also like focus in the right ways. And we've done this quite a bit as part of Gyroscope. There are a few examples, but I'll mostly leave these here for later reference. These came about from our work calibrating gyro pools. But there's many examples where you can just get a lot better kind of liquidity profile by making a much more customized pool than by using kind of like a default stable swap pool. And this chart also kind of walks through that it actually works by kind of like comparing capital efficiencies. But we'll also leave this. You can check on it later if you're interested. What I want to spend the rest of the presentation on then is what we think is a new way to solve decentralized stablecoin liquidity. And kind of the motivation here is that there's a unique ability to decentralize stablecoins. And it's that you can issue in new ways that wouldn't really have been possible in centralized stablecoins. And so the classic example here is something we just saw, actually, for like protocol-owned liquidity and AMOs. A centralized stablecoin just can't do this. It can't issue new stablecoins in this pre-minted sort of way. So that shows that that it exists. But the idea we want to pursue is, like, can you build on this flexibility in a new way that it might be more efficient and might also be safer? And so this is where we want to announce what we're actually building next in Gyroscope, our V2. This is actually the first time we're talking about this mechanism. So you kind of follow us if you want to hear kind of more about where this is going. But I'll try to give you a little flavor quickly. So it builds on a concept that we call duplex yield. And I'll illustrate this, what this means in the next couple of slides. But this slide gives a general overview about like what sort of market is being set up. So on one side of the market, we have idle asset holders. So this could be something like Bitcoin holders, LRTs, or other kind of like top yield-bearing positions already. These are earning what we're calling this duplex yield, and it can be also be earned on top of other yields. The other side of the market here is asset issuance protocols. So stablecoin issuers being one example, but you could also consider like LST issuers. And what they're trying to get out of this mechanism is cheap, scalable liquidity for their assets, and possibly also unlocking a new revenue line. But an important thing at the same time is that you also have this third group, actual people who are using your stablecoin, and we want to make sure they're shielded from risks. And this is through an idea that we call duplex collateralization. So let's dig into a little bit about what this means. I'll give you a little intuition. So the most efficient way to market make is often to borrow assets, as opposed to holding assets on the book. And duplex yield essentially is coming from a more efficient way of market making stablecoins through kind of like an optimized borrow-like mechanism instead of requiring LPs to hold it on the book. And it works through something we call a secured swap line. So this creates basically an ability to exchange one stable for another, and it's insured with a collateral position. And the idea of where lower cost is coming from here in efficiency is that you can actually, through this mechanism, use something like Bitcoin, which has a much lower hurdle rate, lower cost of capital, something like 3 to 5%, to market make stablecoins instead of requiring the hurdle rates of 15 to 30% if you're actually holding the stablecoins on the book. And you can stack these yields on top of each other. So we actually think the future yield stack will look something like this. You have all of these different staking yields already. And the most effective yield, we think, will add this duplex yield, this market-making sort of yield on top. And so the idea is, being more specific than the intuition, is to streamline a sort of borrowing mechanism that is restricted to codified market-making. Main idea here is that you can basically price discriminate between the leverage market, which ends up having very high borrow costs because it has to, as we saw in the previous slide, it has to balance the supply and demand of the leverage market. There's a lot of demand for leverage. But you can price discriminate between this leverage market and other markets, like this sort of market-making market, and that a decentralized stablecoin can do this in a uniquely low way because it has this flexibility about issuance and also wants to foster liquidity for the asset. So this slide walks through kind of how a secured swap line actually works. I'll only be able to give a quick flavor, but you can check back in on it later and there'll be more information coming out as well. There's kind of like three stages to it. You start with the idle asset that you want to earn a yield on, so something like Bitcoin. You have stablecoin issuers who jointly issue against this vault. So these issuers may set their own interest rates, possibly zero if they want to incentivize, or possibly not if they want to kind of risk control. And B could also be borrowed elsewhere, by the way, so you could also pair with USDC, you just don't get as many advantages. And then effectively what's happening is that these A and B are being provided in a secondary market. People can swap through this. And at the point where somebody is swapping one asset for another, These sort of like pre-minted stable coins get backed by the asset that's swapped into the pool, but they're also backed by the collateral. And the collateral provider is being paid for this, which is where this yield is coming from. And the market making losses, basically, are being insured by the collateral, and so not taken on by the protocol. And then this is enforced by liquidations. And then there are various properties you can get. One nice thing is that you get all of this efficient liquidity, but you don't have to trust kind of each other's assets as like stablecoin issuers, and you also don't have to trust market makers. And you can also get conceivably very high capital efficiency. So up to $20 of liquidity for $1 of TVL, basically, if you want to take on that risk. And if you don't, a protocol can set it up differently. So that brings us to kind of the end of the talk. There's kind of a few main takeaways here. But I'll just leave this up, and we can open it up for questions.
Okay, so for our favorite and the most important part, Q&A, please use the QR code and you can also upvote the questions. Okay, the first one will be, will fully algorithmic stablecoins possible in the future?
So I think here it depends what you mean by algorithmic. A lot of people mean algorithmic to be unbacked, which is not the kind of stance we want to take. We think a stablecoin should be backed and fully backed. But if you mean algorithmic in the sense of being automated, then we think yes, and that's how we designed Gyroscope to be basically as automated as possible. But yeah, I wouldn't be very bullish about algorithmic in the sense of being unasset backed. I mean, I think, especially after Terra, that's just obviously a bad idea.
Okay, next question. Why so much hype around Athena? Could you explain what Athena is?
Yeah, so Athena is basically a tokenized, what's called like a carry trade. So you're kind of taking a hedged position, and it takes kind of two sides to a leverage market, and it's the leverage market on centralized exchanges, which get like a lot of demand. And you're basically earning a yield through Athena when there's excess demand for leverage, and you're kind of helping to facilitate that leverage. And so Athena yields can be very good when there's really high demand for leverage, but they can also be low or possibly negative when the demand for leverage goes down a lot.
Okay, and then when issuing a pre-minted way, it's like latent liquidity, meaning you stock up the place smart contract with the tokens that once bought by a user become real?
So the pre-minting idea is basically an extension of how AMOs work today, I suppose. You can fill a pool with basically uncirculating stablecoins, and the idea is that they would enter circulation when somebody actually buys them from the pool, which is why it's kind of parallel to like a minting mechanism and can be thought of as a minting mechanism. You get kind of the efficiencies of being on a secondary market. I hope that answered the question.
Okay, and who are the issuers? What capital they need?
So the target issuers for the mechanism we're building for Gyro V2 is decentralized stablecoin protocols. So the issuers really like the smart contracts, or people like are free to almost issue themselves by using the smart contracts. It's possible that it could also be used by like some other issuers. It's just that like centralized stablecoins in particular usually don't have this flexibility, and so they may not even be able to entertain it. But then the decentralized stablecoin issuers, what they really want is to like get very good liquidity without taking on a bunch of risk for their protocols, which is why we kind of made this like duplex collateralization mechanism, where the aim is to get kind of like the very good properties you might be able to get from something like AMOs and protocol-owned liquidity, even if it's on much more risky pairs, but where the protocol and the normal users of stablecoins get an extra layer of protection. And if something happens, it's insurance that kind of like covers the costs.
Okay, so our last question. Will Spin, your governance token, earn part of fees?
That's the killer question, I guess, isn't it? And there are routes, I suppose, to doing this, but it depends on kind of governance selecting the right route.
Okay, we have 10 more seconds. Do you think CX integration and CCTP-like mechanisms will help out that and stability of decentralized stablecoins?
Yes, so CX integrations, I think, will be very good in terms of sourcing new users because people come through CXs, and CCTP. Across chain easily, because it's a kind of an issue if you have to wait a week all the time to kind of like bridge.
Okay, thank you very much, Arai.